Well, so good evening to you all. I think this evening we're supposed to be talking about Buddhism and daily life. Yes? Okay. So I think this is a subject which is really most extraordinarily important. In fact, it's if I had to choose one subject only to speak about, I would speak about this one. In the traditional approach to Dharma practice, it often appears that the emphasis is on formal practicing, meaning sitting, doing one's meditation, doing one's recitation or prostrations or mandala offerings or whatever, or going to a Dharma center and doing practices in community, or going in the East, going to temples to make offerings. This is Dharma practice. And the rest of the time is so much worldly activity. And sometimes one finds that even the teachers themselves encourage that idea. They also talk about Dharma practice, meaning the formal meditations, rituals, and things which we think of as being dharma. In fact, I was quite horrified to read in a book by an older lama who has since passed away, a very traditional lama, a very great lama, who was asked by one of his disciples, a Westerner. He said, well, the Westerner said, you know, I have a family and I have my job, and so I really don't have much time for practice. What should I do? And he replied, well, never mind. When your children grow up and you can take an early retirement, and then you can start your practice. I have even heard lamas say to me, oh, Anila, you're so lucky, I'm so busy, I have no time for practice. So what we're dealing with this evening is to try to bridge this great schism between the idea of Dharma practice and everyday life. Right? This does not mean that today's talk is not about formal practice. Not because formal practice is not important. Not because a daily sitting is not important. But that has already been dealt with. Right? Everybody, if they have some path which they are following, have already their daily practice which they are doing. This is very important, but we're not going to deal with it today. You can take that as a given. What we are going to talk about is, all right, we have, even if we do 1 or 2 hours of practice, formal practice every day, and many people do not do as much as 1 or 2 hours, but even if we do, we still have 22 hours left in the day, and what are we going to do with that? Because if we don't do something with that, then there is never going to be any real change, any real inner transformation. If we take the path of practice, the traditional path of practice, we have what are called the 6 paramita. The 6 paramita are translated sometimes as the transcendental activities, or sometimes as the perfections. Anyway, they are actions which are needed in order to attain Buddhahood. Every one of them. Right? Now, these 6 paramita are giving, ethics, patience or tolerance, enthusiasm, you could say, or effort in the sense of really doing something joyfully, meditation and wisdom. You will notice that meditation is only one. In other words, Buddhist practice is not only meditation. There's also giving, ethics, patience, for a start. Now, in order to develop these qualities of generosity, openness of heart, ethical conduct, you know, pure moral conduct, which is not harming anybody, which is not causing any problems on a physical level to anybody, or patience, we need other people, right? I mean, sitting up in a cave, it's very easy to be generous. I could just throw out some crumbs to the birds. Great generosity. Patience. Patience to who? You know, to the wolves howling or to the, you know, the weather gods because they keep making it snow. I mean, who is one to be patient to? So, to develop these qualities, which are extremely important, we need other people. The Buddha never ever said that meditation alone is enough. Actually, it isn't enough. We need also, as well as cultivating the mind, we need also to open up the heart. And these qualities open the heart. There is no nicer way to relate to people than by giving them something. Giving them something with a kind heart. Right? Not just something we don't want anyway. Maybe something that we really do want. And patience, because during the day, we are all going to meet with people who push our buttons. You know, I mean, either within the family or within our workplace or wherever, there are always going to be people who create problems for us, who annoy us. Who seem as though their only function on earth is to create obstacles. So what are we going to do with these people? You know, we can sit there fretting and frustrated and, you know, thinking up glorious technicolor versions of our revenge. Or we can see that patience, the ability to have tolerance and really sympathize with people who are difficult is an incredibly important virtue. The Buddha praised it over and over again. He said the greatest austerity is patience. And how are we ever going to develop patience unless we have someone to try it? Unless we have someone who annoys us, we are never going to be able to develop this wonderful quality. So therefore, when people do annoy us, we should, instead of being irritated, think, ah, here is a genuine helper on my path, without whom nothing. Just think about that, you know? Really. I mean, maybe I don't have time to tell you this story. It's a nice story. I'll tell you anyway. Okay. So it's a story that illustrates this thing about dealing with difficult people. Very simple story. It's about a Catholic saint called St. Thérèse of Lisieux. She was a French girl from a sort of middle-class family in Normandy. She died at the end of the last century. She became a Carmelite nun when she was 15, and she died at the age of 24 of tuberculosis. She is now the patron saint of France, along with Joan of Arc. It's hard to know why she's the patron saint. She never did miracles, she never had visions, but she was special. Anyway, she lived in a nunnery with about 30 other nuns. Now, you are dealing with an enclosed nunnery. They never saw anybody else. You do not choose who are going to be your 30 people to spend the rest of your life with. It's not like you choose all your best friends and say, let's get together. You just go into the nunnery and then you find out who you've got there. And that's it for the rest of your life. I mean, even if we had only the people who are right here, right now, imagine, we are never going to meet anybody else. How would we feel about each other? Right? So she was in this nunnery, And there was one nun there whom she could not abide. She couldn't stand the way she looked, she couldn't stand the way she talked, she couldn't stand the way she walked, the way she ate, everything about it just... Therese was quite fastidious. And during their hours of silence in the chapel, you know, you imagine this stone chapel, very echoing. And this nun who sat close to Therese would make clicking noises. And she never knew when she was going to click. So she would sit there waiting for this click noise. And she would feel these beads of cold sweat soaking her, waiting. You know, she was about to strangle this woman. So she realized this is for the rest of her life, you know. You can't get away from it. So she thought, well, what to do? The woman is not going to change. Obviously, God finds something in her pleasing because he called her to be a bride. So obviously she has something which Therese felt she was missing. So the point was, the woman was not going to change. So was Therese going to spend the rest of her life gritting her teeth and trying to find another corridor to go down every time she saw her coming? Was not possible. It's a very small nunnery. So the only thing she could do was change her own attitude. So instead of trying to avoid, she went out of her way to meet her, to give her her very nicest smile, really from her heart. She started making her little gifts. She started anticipating the woman's wishes and doing little things to please her. She started treating her as though she was the person she most loved in all the world. So that this nun said, well, really, I just can't understand why you love me so much. And Therese thought, well, if only you knew. But what happened was that in the end, she really began to like the lady. She was actually okay, you know, it wasn't so bad. And in the end, they became quite good friends. You see, nothing had changed, and yet everything had changed. Instead of avoiding, she now went open-hearted. Do you see? It's not something miraculous. It's not something impossible. It's something we can all do. Any situation which is difficult, if we change our attitude, the situation can change. Normally, we try to avoid difficult things in our lives. We want everything to be very smooth and harmonious, everything the way we want it to go. But that way, we don't learn very much. One time when I was in South India, I went to see an astrologer. And I said to him, well, I have two choices. Either I can go back into retreat or I can start a nunnery. So what looks best? And he said, well, if you go back into retreat, very harmonious, very peaceful, really a very good and easy situation. If you start the nunnery, lots of conflicts, lots of difficulties, lots of problems, but both are good. So you decide. So I thought, well, obviously, back into retreat, quick. And then I spoke to a Catholic priest that I knew, and he said, well, it's obvious. You start the nunnery. He said, what use is it, all this peace and harmony? He said, we are like rough pieces of wood. It's not enough to stroke ourselves always with silk and velvet. We need sandpaper. It's sandpaper that makes us smooth. So I'm starting this nunnery. So his fault, right? So that's the first thing. That we can bring a different attitude to our lives. And we can see everything which happens to us as an opportunity to really learn. What can we learn from this? how can I develop qualities which are needed on the path? Every single person we meet is our opportunity, and especially in a family, because in a family it is extremely easy to get dragged down into habitual reactions which are not skillful. For the last few years since I left India, I've been staying quite frequently with couples. And that has in itself been a great education. One wonders, how did these couples come together? And now they're together, what is keeping them joined? Because so often they treat each other far worse than they would presumably treat their worst enemy. You know, no, really, the things they say to each other. Ouch! You wouldn't say that to anybody, and yet they say it to the people that presumably they love the most. I mean, sometimes I think it would be a very good idea to have at least a recording machine, if not a video, just for to record these, you know, interactions between couples, and then play it back so that they could see themselves. Because every time it comes again and again and again, the same old script. And it doesn't work. So why not change the script? As Buddhists, we are talking all the time about may beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then you see, you know, the people who we are most responsible for, the people that we are most intimate with, are the people to whom we are giving the least happiness. It's very easy to sit down on your cushion and think, may all sentient beings be happy. And there's these little SBs out there on the horizon who are glowing with joy. But the person in front of you, the person who then comes in, you know, the child or the partner who then comes in and starts complaining or starts interrupting or whatever, and, you know, this irritation which comes from them, or the way we talk with them, just the tone of the voice. Yet, what sentient being in all the world is more important than the one in front of us? That's the one we have to make happy. So there is no greater test of our Dharma practice than our own family. If we can make our family happy, then maybe we have a foundation to talk about making other beings happy. If we cannot even make our own family happy, then what right have we to think that we are bodhisattvas on the bodhisattva path, and colleagues at work, and people that we meet. In our heart, we should always have the thought, may you be well and happy. Every person that we meet, under whatever circumstances, our first thought should be just spontaneously, even if it's not thinking, just that attitude of, may you be happy. An openness, instead of closing all the doors in case somehow they might do something which offends, or because they're not important. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is a perfect exemplar of this. Right? Every person he meets, whether it's the President of the United States, or the Pope, or a road worker in Nepal, he treats them all the same. He takes your hand and he looks right in your eyes, and at that moment you're the only person that exists for him. And you exist for him in love. Totally non-judgmental, completely for you. Now we can all learn to do this a little bit. We know that we want people to be nice to us. We know we don't want people to be rude to us or to ignore us or to hurt us. We're all very vulnerable. So do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's so simple. Just that as a Dharma practice, to be kind. I mean, if we cannot even manage that much, what right have we to think that we are spiritual practitioners? Trungpa Rinpoche, Chögyam Trungpa, his regent was called Usa Tenzin. He was an American. And one time, Daegu Kyentse Rinpoche was at the center in America. And Chenzi Rinpoche said to Usa Tenzin, he said, well, you're the Dharma regent of Trungpa Rinpoche, so really I should give you some special teaching. as you're the Dharma regent. And so come and see me around midnight tonight. So then Rasar Tenzin says, oh, wow, you know, finally, you know, the real secret teaching's going to come now, you know, because I'm after all the Dharma regent. And he's recognized my worth, and here it comes. So at midnight, he took his silk kata, and he went to see Tenzin Rinpoche, and he went in, he prostrated, he offered the kata, and he sat there. And then Tenzin Rinpoche looked at him, and he said, ah, yes, I have to tell you something. Be kind. Always remember to be kind. And that was it. Now, if Usar Tenzin had remembered that, things would have been very different. The Dalai Lama himself says, my religion is kindness. If we are doing any practice and our hearts are not becoming more open, more kind, more caring for others, there is something very sadly wrong in our brain. The second thing for bringing Dharma into our everyday lives is to practice being present. In all Buddhist schools, Theravada, Zen, Tibetan, there is this emphasis on mindfulness, awareness, attention, whatever you want to call it. So we will explain this a little bit here. What we are talking about is bringing a sense of knowing into the activities of the day. Knowing, being present, being aware, being conscious. There is a slight difference between, but it's a very profound difference, between being aware and being concentrated. If we're reading a very fascinating book, we are completely absorbed in the book. And in that case, we are concentrated. To know that we are absorbed in the book is awareness. Do you see the difference? So what we are trying to develop in Buddhist practice is this quality of being present, of knowing what is happening in the moment, just as it is. You see, normally, whatever is happening, whatever is received by us through our senses, through our eyes and our ears, our nose, our mouth, our skin, and what is interpreted by the sixth sense, that is the mind, as the sense input hits onto the sense organs and is then received into the sense consciousnesses, that is just bare phenomena. But immediately the mind takes it and begins to interpret. It begins to start judging it, interpreting it, commentating on it, twisting it around, until what we have is not actually the thing in itself, but just our version of it. So, for example, if something happens and you have three or five people giving a version later of what occurred, you have five completely different versions. I'm sure you've all experienced this. I know I have. I mean, something happened and then later I hear my friend describing it. And I'm thinking, no, it wasn't like that at all. You know, it was like this and this and this. How could you have been so distorted a view? But if somebody else heard my version, they'd think, it wasn't like that. Why was she thinking it was like this and this and this? Each of us takes what is apparent and then distorts it into our own version. And we think that is the reality. And we react to that. Do you understand what we're talking about? This is what causes a lot of our problems, is that we don't see things as they really are. We just see our own very highly colored and very highly flavored version. So in Buddhism, it is considered very important to start cleaning the lenses, to start getting things back into focus, so that we come closer and closer to what is actually happening and not our own private version of it. All right? So one of the ways of doing this is to learn to be present in the moment. This is a huge subject, and I can only skim the surface of it here. But there are various ways we can do this, and one of the ways which is very effective is to understand, just as the Zen people say, that there is no action which we do which is more important or less important than any other action. It all depends on the degree of awareness and consciousness which we bring to it. So whether you're sitting up on a Dharma throne giving a Dharma talk, or whether you're sitting on your cushion doing your meditation, or whether you're out in the kitchen cutting vegetables or scrubbing the toilets or whatever you're doing, none of those activities are more or less important than any other. It all depends on the degree of awareness which you bring to that activity. If one is sitting on one's cushion, but one's body's on the cushion and one's mind is in the bazaar, then that is absolutely useless, however perfect it looks as a Dharma activity. On the other hand, if you're sweeping leaves, but you're doing it totally conscious, totally knowing, then that is an immaculate Dharma activity. Do you understand? Thich Nhat Hanh, this great Vietnamese master, he talks about washing dishes to wash dishes. And so this is a very important point. You see, normally when we, for example, wash dishes, we are washing dishes in order to get clean dishes. So the point is not that we're washing the dishes, that we try to get away as quickly as possible. All we are interested in is that when we're going to have clean dishes, and then we can go on to the next task. So while we're washing the dishes, our minds are in 1,000 different directions. We're thinking of something somebody said yesterday, or something we did this morning, or we're caught up in some fantasy world, or we're thinking about what we're going to do when the dishes are clean, or whatever. The one thing we're not thinking about is the dishes, right? And this wouldn't matter. I mean, you think, so what? We get clean dishes anyway. But the point is that we lead our whole lives doing that. Even while we're eating the most delicious food, we're already thinking about the next mouthful. What's for dessert? And while we're eating dessert, we're thinking, well, I wish we'd had somebody else's dessert. I mean, we're not ever experiencing. And we lead our whole life like this. And this is why our lives feel so stale and empty and meaningless. There's nothing wrong with our lives, it's what we're doing with them. The French say, je m'ennuie, I bore myself. So what we have to do is learn to wash the dishes to wash the dishes, which means that while we are washing the dishes, we are completely present. We feel the water, we feel the soap suds, we are conscious of each dish, and we are completely with what we are doing in the moment, experiencing it, knowing how the body feels, what is in our mind at this moment, how our mind is now experiencing, tasting that moment, being present in that moment. If we can really do this without interpretations, without judgments, without commentary, then that becomes so extremely clean and vivid, and the mind becomes very clear and very relaxed, and then we get clean dishes just the same, and then we can go on to the next task, and again we're present with it. Now, being present is not totally easy. It's very simple. The problem is that at the beginning, when we try to be present, sometimes what it happens is that we're thinking, oh yes, now I'm really aware. And of course, as soon as we are thinking, I am really aware, we are no longer aware. We're just thinking about being aware. Do you understand? Because really being present, really knowing, is nonverbal. It's just a state of knowing. And that is extremely relaxing for the mind, actually. The mind then becomes very clear. And it begins to see things as they are. And then whatever task we do, it's fine. You know, we can completely be one with it. And it reveals its own special, unique qualities. Our minds have become very blunt. This is the problem. So then everything seems boring. I mean, yeah, this wall was very pretty, but now I've seen it so many times, you don't even notice it anymore. So what we need is to get that childlike mind back again, which sees things very vividly in the moment as though we are seeing them for the first time. And that includes people, looking at people, especially people we think we know, as if we've never seen them before. I used to do that in the cave, because I lived in this cave, and, you know, sometimes for years and years, that's all I saw. So I would go to another part, it's a very small cave, but I would go to another part, instead of there, I would sit here, and then I would close my eyes, and then I would open them up and look at the cave as if I had never seen it before. And it was true, you know, if you do that, you see all sorts of things you never noticed. Really. And people. If you look at them as if you've never seen them before, then they, you know, and listen to them, really listen, as if you've never heard them before. Really listen to what they're saying and their tone. Instead of, you know, they say the first few words and you don't hear the rest because you know what's going to be. Really listening and trying to respond in a way which is totally fresh and appropriate. Instead of in the same old stale way which one has been relating for so many months and years. Do you understand? Then everything we do in our life becomes interesting. Everything becomes a way of waking up, because the spiritual life is about waking up. We are all asleep. We might be ever so intelligent and vivid and bright, but we're asleep. We're just dreaming. So we need to wake ourselves up. And these moments of clarity, these moments of being really present, of really knowing, are moments of beginning to really wake up. One way to do this is to take everyday activities. I mean, it's like everything else, it needs practice. We're habituated to being unaware. So when we try to become aware, we forget very quickly, because the inertia of the mind is very deep. So we have to start by, like with everything, you know, start to get the feel of it, begin to practice, to begin to strengthen this quality of knowing in us. And so one of the ways to do this is by taking very simple actions, which we perform every day, usually totally mindlessly, such as, you know, in the morning getting up and combing hair or brushing our teeth, or if you're a man, shaving, or if you smoke, then smoking a cigarette or drinking a cup of coffee or tea. Actions which normally we give no attention to, they're so automatic. And to make the determination to take one of these actions and completely be present while one is performing it, to know it. Doesn't mean that we have to do it with, you know, like in some systems, you know, intending, lifting, touching, combing. You don't have to do it like that, you know. I mean, you'll be late for work. Right? It's not necessary to do that. It's not necessary even to go much slower, a little bit slower in the beginning. But what we're trying to do is to develop this quality of being aware. So while we're combing our hair, we know we're combing our hair, that's all. The Buddha said, when we are sitting, we know we are sitting. When we are standing, we know we are standing. When we are walking, we know we are walking. When we are lying down, we know we are lying down. That's it. But mostly when we're sitting, we don't know we're sitting. We're not really conscious of. Even when we're walking, we're usually not even conscious of that. We're thinking 1,001 other things. Our legs are going plop, 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 but we're thinking, where are our minds? So it's to bring the mind back into the body to know what is happening in the body, in the mind, to make things become vivid, to wake up. And so to use very simple actions in the beginning, it's a way to practice learning how to be in the present. Just, you know, you combing your hair, you know it, you feel the comb, you feel the hand, you don't comment about it, you don't have a whole inner dialogue about this. You just know, in a very relaxed way, not tense. Just relaxing, just knowing, it's so simple. And as the mind begins to get accustomed to being present, to knowing what is happening, we can begin to develop this quality more and more in our everyday lives. Again, often taking very simple circumstances when we have, you know, there are always times, even in the most busy day, when we have a few moments to just be present. In Delhi, in India, they have traffic lights. And written across the red traffic light is the word relax, okay? So when we are at a red traffic light, instead of fuming, we can think, great, this is meditation time, and become present. Just bring ourselves back. We are sitting here, hands on the wheels, breathing in, breathing out, completely present in this moment. What a wonderful opportunity. Waiting for your computer to change, waiting for anything. Instead of getting, you know, present. Here I am sitting. What am I doing in this moment? That's the question. How is my body? How does it feel? How are my feelings? What am I thinking in this moment? Not judging it. Just knowing it. One of the things when one is in the presence of very great masters is this sense that they are completely present. And we can all do this. It's not something which is difficult. The only difficulty is that we don't have the determination to keep going. You know, we have tremendous inertia. We have great inertia to be mindless. And as soon as we try to be mindful, there is this resistance. We don't remember. We forget all the time. Our minds sink back down. It's so much more comfortable. But that is the way of an animal. That is the way of stupidity. It is not the way of enlightenment. Enlightenment means waking up. So then, every moment of our day when we remember, we can just bring our attention, even for a few seconds, half a minute, during the day, as often as we remember, to what is happening in this moment, to knowing, to just seeing, you know? I mean, there's a big difference. I can feel it immediately between sitting and talking to you and knowing that I am sitting and talking to you. The moment I stand back and look at it, I can feel everything change, even in my body. My whole posture, even my voice will change. It's like one adds a whole other dimension. And yet it's so simple. So everything which happens to us in our daily life can be an opportunity. If we don't see that every action which we do is a way of learning how to be present, is learning how to be in the moment. Every person that we meet is a way of being present, and present in friendliness, in kindness, in understanding.
How about your young students?
How many of you are not with your young students?
Padvajrayana also has ways of transforming daily life into our adhara activity. When we realize that every action which we are performing at that moment is the most important thing we could possibly be doing because it's what we are doing, then everything becomes a joy. Do you understand? You see, normally we think, oh, this is really important, that's really useless, and so on, we are always discriminating and our minds become very stressed and tense. But if we see that whatever is the thing we are doing at this moment is the most important thing we could be doing, because, as I say, this is what we're doing. Anything else is just an idea. It's not the thing in itself. So therefore, if everything we do as if it were the most important thing in the world at that moment, then we do it with a kind of respect. I mean, I know myself, if I'm writing a letter and I'm just writing a letter, and if I write a letter thinking this is the most important thing I could possibly be doing, everything changes. On one level, nothing's changed, but on the other hand, everything's changed. If we think our lives are meaningless, it's because we don't put any meaning in it. It's not the fault of the life. It is a very good idea to try to do some retreats, you know, to do some of these 10-day retreats, or month-long if one can afford it, retreats of intensive practice, because at these times then one really gets a taste of what a mind which is more silent and more concentrated is about. And then that one can begin to develop in one's daily life. It really helps a lot. So any of you who have the opportunity to do more intense and extended practice, even for a short time, it's really very recommended. The thing is, we have to ask ourselves, how serious are we about? We want to think that we're all on some kind of spiritual path, but how much energy are we going to do for it? We would all like to be enlightened, whatever that means. Most people hope that their practice is going to make them peaceful. It might, but it might not. But how much of ourselves are we really willing to invest in this? Perhaps I should. You think of the year 2000, you're having the Olympics here. Now, you think of all those athletes who are practicing with the hopes that they are going to be selected for the Olympics, with the hopes that they then might win a medal. That's the highest hope, is that they're going to win a medal. But just in order to win a medal, these people give all their energies. They go on special diets, they curtail their social life. Their whole thought, their whole intention is just on winning, on being selected and on winning. They spend hours and hours and hours a day exercising, going through enormous deprivations and difficulties and exhaustions for a medal. And yet, people here would say, oh yes, I want to get enlightened. And how much are we giving for that? If it was even suggested you might try to refine your diet, everybody would be up in arms. What to speak of all the hours and hours and hours of practice or whatever. And yet, what is greater than enlightenment? And that's for life. Lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, we vow that we wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings, I mean, can you imagine anything more tremendous than that? For the sake of all beings throughout space, throughout eternity, we will save them, we say. And then if it's suggested that you might try getting up half an hour earlier, oh no. Are we really willing to try to undo our negative habitual patterns and reform into skillful patterns? Patterns which will help ourselves and help others. It's all up to us. Nobody can do it for us. Even if the Buddha was standing here in front of you, which he is but you can't see, he couldn't do it for you. We each have to do it for ourselves. And so if years and years go by, nothing inside is really changing, nothing is really transforming, it's not the fault of the Dharma. It's our lack of real dedication and commitment. Is a path of joy, so you don't have to look so serious. Actually, you know, if we do put a little effort into it, skillful effort, if we really do make some try in our daily lives to incorporate a little kindness, a little more awareness, just to be more present and more conscious of people and our effect on people, and the responsibility for our actions, our bodily actions, our verbal actions, and our thoughts. We have to take responsibility, not just for their effects now, but in longer term. Everything we say and do is throwing a stone into a pond. It has many ripples. We have to be conscious of what we're doing. And if we live life in that way, there will be a change. Our lives will really genuinely begin to lighten up. I think one of the great qualities on the Dharma path, which is never mentioned, is to have a lightness and a humor, not to take ourselves too seriously. You notice the lamas are always laughing. I mean, even His Holiness the Dalai Lama, with all the pain that he receives daily from these awful accounts coming from everywhere of the suffering of so many beings. And there he is, the Bodhisattva of compassion. You know, his heart bleeds for all these people. But when you look into his eyes, all you see is, you know, jumping, sparkling, happy little eyes. It's not because he doesn't care. So all of us, we should also have that aspect of lightness also in our lives and towards others. One of the things we can give to others is a sense of joy. Listening to people, caring for them, letting them know that you're there for them. But also making them feel lighter. I mean, if people in our presence end up feeling worse and worse and more negative, there's something wrong. I mean, people should end up feeling, you know, they come in all, and they should go out smiling. Or at least looking slightly, you know, a little bit more relieved. This much we can give to beings. Yes? So what I'm really trying to say is that we really have to know that if we want any genuine breakthroughs in insight, any real inner transformations, this is a full-time job. And the more we commit ourselves to transforming our daily life into our spiritual practice, the quicker and the more complete will be the transformation. It's up to us completely. We can sit and moan and groan and think, oh, if only I had more time for practice. Or we can realize that every breath we take is a practice. It's up to us. We can make our lives totally meaningless. We can make it totally meaningful. Nobody can do it for us. Okay, are there any questions? Becomes increasingly aware. Aware means also being very clear. As one begins to be very clear, one begins to see things as they really are. As one begins to see things as they really are, one begins to see people, really people, and not just our projections of people. As one begins to see people, one begins to see the pain in their eyes behind the mask which most people are wearing. When one sees the pain in others' eyes and recognizes it as often the pain in one's own eyes, then there naturally arises the desire that they should be happy, that they should not suffer, at least not for themselves. It's a natural natural sense of empathy and compassion. Seeing one's own pain, one sees the pain. That's the connection. In all spiritual practice, these two go together, you know, wisdom and compassion, that along with cultivating the mind, one also must absolutely open the mind. That's why I said at the beginning, however deep your meditation, if it's not affecting your heart, if your heart isn't opening towards others naturally, there's something wrong. Open up.
Try to see.
Oh, yes, certainly. One thing, I think, if insight naturally arises, what naturally, if it's genuine insight, there will be compassion arising too. But in addition, there are, in Buddhism, many meditations for developing loving kindness and for developing which at first are sort of artificial, you know, when you're trying. But as you keep working on it, then eventually it becomes spontaneous. It's like you're digging down in your heart, and at first it's all kind of dry and hard, but if you keep digging long enough, then it begins to get more moist, and then in the end you kind of access to this whole flood, this whole spring of natural love. Which is locked in our hearts. It's not that we have to develop it, something we don't have. What we really have to do is learn how to gain access into the love and compassion which is buried deep in everybody's heart. As part of our nature.
Can I ask one more?
Yes.
Is it really necessary to go through the formal processes such as the prostrations and the non-dirt, or is it enough to really just try to apply the Eightfold Path and the Paramitas?
I don't want to be too heretical here, but of course the important thing is to what we are trying to do is to gain a knowledge of who we really are.
And anything which we can do, which will help us with that, is a good thing. For different people, different approaches work better. I mean, obviously, to gain enlightenment, you don't need to have ever done prostrations. For some people, prostrations can be a very skillful means of opening up, of surrendering, of reducing a sense of pride. Why should I prostrate? And all these things, you know, it can be very, very helpful. It's a very beautiful practice. It's not essential. It's useful. But most important is to really find out who we really are, who we really are not, to begin to clear away our false identifications and to open up our heart.
Do you believe it's necessary to have a teacher?
I think it's extraordinarily helpful. That is a difficult question, because for some people they don't have the relationship with a teacher. I don't think we should sit around waiting till the perfect teacher turns up before we start practicing. For one thing, there is a lot of things which we can do on our own without a teacher or without a very formal connection with a teacher. There are many teachers coming through. There are many books. There are many things which we can do on our own, so that if we meet with our teacher, the perfect teacher, we will be ready. Otherwise, even if we met with the Buddha himself, all he could say was, well, do some purification and learn how to, you know, tame your mind. We wouldn't be ready for his mind blessing. So, of course, to have a teacher is the most perfect situation, a qualified teacher. But in the meantime, there are many, many things we can do on our own. And ultimately, of course, we each have to learn to access to our own wisdom mind. The ultimate teacher is our own wisdom mind.
Anila, you talked a little at the beginning about the nunnery. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to share a little bit with us about what this project is and what it's for and what value it might be?
Okay, well, I'm sure most of the people here know the Tibetan situation. In 1959, His Holiness the Dalai Lama left Tibet after the invasion of the communist forces, and along with him into India and Nepal came about 100,000 Tibetan refugees. Now, at the same time, of course, in Tibet, their religion and culture was being systematically destroyed, along with the monasteries and the inhabitants of these monasteries. So when these refugees came to India, which was for them an extremely traumatic situation, I mean, they were in a totally alien environment. The language, the climate, the people, the customs, everything was totally alien to them. And so once they had began to recover from their shock, their first consideration was to preserve their culture. And for them, of course, their culture meant Buddhism. And so for the next many years, they gave enormous amounts of effort to restoring as many of the traditional monasteries as possible, and to founding monastic colleges and retreat centers, and training up whole new generations of young monks so that the Buddhist traditions would not be destroyed. They would be continued. And, I mean, of course, this is wonderful. I mean, it's amazing what they did and how well they succeeded. And now there are many hundreds of monasteries and many, many thousands of monks, and there is no danger that the Dharma is going to fade away. However, in this general enthusiasm for preserving the Dharma, somehow the nuns sort of got overlooked. And for the first 25 years after they were in exile, as far as I know, the only nunnery which was in existence was a small Kagyupa nunnery, which had in fact been founded by a Western nun, an English nun called Frida Beatty, or Sister Palmore. And for many, many years, this was the only nunnery, which meant that all the other nunnery, or any other nun that there was nowhere for them to live, nowhere for them to be trained. So mostly if you saw nuns, they were just wearing sort of maroon-colored chubas, you know, the laywoman's clothing, and often carrying somebody else's babies. They worked as nursemaids, they worked as servants, because there was no support. When I lived in Lahul, which is a Himalayan valley, I lived in a monastery which had both monks and nuns. Everybody had their own separate house going up the hill. But while the monks were in the forefront doing all the rituals and doing the retreats, the nuns were either in the kitchen doing the cooking, or they were down in the villages with their families, working for the families in order to get supplies. They did not do retreats. They did not get the teachings. They did not do the rituals. They were just the servants for the monks. In recent years, groups of women have understood this situation, and now they are starting to found monasteries for nuns. One of the motivating factors was that some Western nuns, very educated women, one of them, who is a good friend of mine, had an MA in Buddhist philosophy. They came to Dharamsala, to the School of Dialectics, which is a school where there is debating and philosophical training. And they requested to join this school. And because there was nothing in the constitution which said actually women cannot join, or of course women had never joined, but there wasn't actually anything in writing saying they couldn't, then they let them join. And so you had these nuns, these Western nuns, who in the beginning didn't even know Tibetan, but they learned Tibetan, because everything of course is in Tibetan, including all the stylized debating and this sort of thing, and all the studies in Tibetan. And they did extremely well. And I mean, they stayed for many years and they were studying with all the monks and the tulkus. And meantime, the nuns looked at this, the Tibetan nuns, and said, hey, now wait a minute. If they can do it, why can't we? They don't even know Tibetan. At least it's our language. And then the Western nuns said to the Tibetan nuns, of course you can do it. If we can do it, you can do it. So then they began to organize small nunneries and invite, well, the Geshe's were not interested, but the higher students at the dialectic school who were friends of these girls, they promised to come and teach. And so they began to teach. Now, it still was not and still is not the perfect situation, because whereas monks who are in a training situation have nothing to do except study. For the nuns, because they did not have support, they not only had to do all the cooking and cleaning for the nunnery, but they also had to do a lot of pujas for the lay people in order to get support for the nunnery. So a lot of their time was taken up with doing these pujas, these rituals, which the lay people sponsored. But even so, they studied very hard, many of them studying until, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning and then getting up at 5 o'clock to do the early morning rituals. And last year, for the first time in Tibetan history, they had 60 nuns debating in front of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, plus so many hundreds of geshes and monks and lay people, for
For 2 weeks, they debated. This had never, ever happened in Tibetan history before. It was always considered debating wasn't necessary for nuns. Nuns wouldn't need to debate. They had never, ever done this before. And they did extremely well. I mean, it was an enormous breakthrough. So what we are trying to do with the nunnery, which we are starting here, my Lama many years ago had asked me to start a nunnery. 2 or 3 times he said to me, I would like you to start a nunnery. And I just said, oh yeah. And then in 1980 he passed away, and now he's a 17-year-old tulku. And a few years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, when I was at the monastery, then the lamas there, the Rinpoches, said, we really need a nunnery, so please start one. And at that time I thought, yes, now is the time. We do need a nunnery. There's nowhere for women to be trained in my whole tradition. In my particular tradition, there is nothing for the training of nuns. So I said, yes, okay. So then later I presented them my ideas on how I was going to start this nunnery, and they said, yes, this is really very good. You please do that. We will support you in every way, but of course we all have our own projects in Tibet and in Nepal, and so we can't help you with the funds. It was, in all my life, I never think about money. I always live just thinking, as I need something, it will just naturally come, and it always has naturally come. And then suddenly I was sent off to Asia, not knowing anybody, not even being given the name of one single sponsor by all those kind Tibetan nuns, knowing nobody, and told, okay, raise $100,000. So this started my new career. Okay, what we are trying to do in the nunnery is to create an environment where first the nuns will be trained. They will be trained in philosophy. They will also learn English and some modern subjects, because it's important that they have that sense of confidence, of worth. It's very hard for the nuns to believe that they are worthy. Always the idea for nuns is that somehow, I mean, I know it for myself, my monastery regards me as being a kind of, you know, honorary member, but the feeling is, and they've said it, well, somehow you made a mistake, you've got this time a female body, never mind, you be a good girl in this lifetime, and next lifetime you can come back as a man and join the monastery. Right? So this is the message which you're always given, that you are somehow substandard. The Tibetan word for, the ordinary Tibetan word for a woman and a wife is chemen, kiemen, which means low-born, inferior birth. And that's the message you get, that you're second grade. So we have to boost the confidence of them. And so we will give them a course in study, but also I think at least for 2 or 3 months a year there will also be meditation, because it's very important to balance practice. And then they will go into retreat and do practice. In my Lama's monastery in India, as in Tibet, we have a group of yogis. They are monks. They are celibate. But they wear dreadlocks and white skirts, and in Tibet they lived in caves, and they follow the Milarepa tradition, and they are called Thobden. In Tibet, my Lama had a nunnery with 400 nuns, and within these nuns were a group of Thobden Ma, right, these females of this lineage who also had, as it happened, dreadlocks and white skirts, and they lived in caves too. And there is a very special lineage coming through Milarepa and Rechupa, which is particular to my particular tradition.
And in that, there is one section which is especially just for women. Now, this lineage, this female lineage, as far as we know, was eradicated in Tibet after the Cultural Revolution. We haven't heard anything about the Togdenma. But there are two lamas, one yogi, one lama, who hold this lineage. And they have promised that if we can prepare girls to be at a point where they can receive this lineage, that they will transmit it. When I asked them to transmit it, their comment was only, well, you better be quick because we're not getting any younger. The youngest is now in his mid-60s, and the other is in his 70s. And Tibetans don't live that long usually, so we do have to hurry. So one of the aims of this nunnery is to produce a certain core of these Togdenma, but also to produce nuns who really, you know, have knowledge and have experience, so that later on they can themselves, some of them, become teachers and help other women, as well as anyone else who would like to have a female teacher. In particular, I'm also interested in helping girls from the border regions like Ladakh, Lahu, Kinur, and maybe Bhutan, who belong to this tradition but have never had the opportunity for studies. Recently, one Ladakhi nun organized some teachings on the monastic code, on the Vinaya, for nuns in Ladakh. And I saw a video of it, and one of these nuns was crying and saying, I've been a nun for 40 years. This is the first teaching I have ever received. So this is what we're trying to do. I mean, it's hard for you to understand sitting here. You have never been discriminated because of what sex you are. You cannot imagine how it is in Asia. I mean, these women have given up everything, and yet they receive nothing, almost nothing in return. But they have great devotion. Along with the nunnery, we also will have an international retreat center for women, where women from all over can come and practice. It doesn't matter what tradition. I hope in time some of our nuns will become teachers, because there's a great dearth of female teachers. Incidentally, we also will run a small clinic which will also serve the villages. And basically that's it. What we are trying to do is to create a whole generation of nuns who finally are fully qualified. And I hope in the future that now, as more and more nuns begin to take up their role, that it will definitely have an influence on society and benefit many people in the future.
Can I just ask another mm-hmm. thing? I'm very touched by what you've shared with us. Can I ask a really practical question?
Sure.
If any of us here want to support this project, how mm-hmm. do we do it?
Well, we have started a bank account in Australia. That seemed the most practical thing to do. And so, you know, money which is given will be placed in that bank account, and checks made out to Donju Gatso Nunnery will also be placed there. Anyone who is in the future wants to hear about how the nunnery is getting on and is interested in hearing about it, or maybe in supporting a nun or any of our projects, please, there is some paper outside. Please put your name and addresses. Write it very clearly. This I ask you, because if you don't write clearly, then maybe I will copy the address wrong and you won't get the information, so it's a waste of time. So please write your name and address nice and clearly, and we will keep you informed. Once we have gotten ourselves really underway, which should happen by early next year, then we will also have newsletters and things to let people know how we're getting on. Okay. So shall we dedicate?